Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 30, titled Deconstructing the Self.
Where were the points of concern and uncertainty or whatever that anybody had about that issue of non-duality? Non-duality, really, it's really simple, but on the other hand, inconceivable. So how would you formulate whatever question it was, or what did you say about it? Whatever you,
nothing.
Your comment? What?
Nothing.
What, nothing?
No, okay, so one is the...
So you jumped to chapter 9, in other words, the Dharma door of non-duality?
As far as I can tell, non-duality is like...
Well, it is, but there's a particular
everywhere.
Famous chapter.
Right.
Which is the ninth chapter in this numbering, called the opening, entering the Dharma door of non-duality.
Right, we did not jump that far.
I see.
I almost jumped to the mustard seed, but I thought we would save that for the next one.
That's a little... Yeah, right, okay.
But we did explore that one and had some fun with it.
We'll explore that tonight.
Great.
And the thing, you know, one of the great things about this sutta is that it's only 108 pages in translation. And yet it has, there's sort of five main classes of Mahayana sutras, you could say. One of them is what's called the Jewel Heap Sutra Collection, 51 sutras. And that collection is like the chapters 3 and 4 in the sense that dualistic Buddhists, you know, monks and or, a lot of monks actually, and also chauvinist lay people, are taken to task sometimes by elderly ladies, sometimes by young girls, sometimes by Manjushri or Buddha or something. And so in a way, 3 and 4 give you a taste of that whole collection of sutras. The Jewel Heap, Ratnakuta, or the Jewel Heap Sutras. Then the visionary one about showing the Pure Land. And then in the end, there's another Pure Land vision where after Vimalakirti is identified, I'm jumping around because a lot of you read it anyway, but after Vimalakirti is identified as an emanation of the Buddha Akshobhya from the eastern Buddha land or Buddhaverse called Abhirati, super pleasure, literally it's called. After he's revealed as being that, then Buddha Shakyamuni says, well, Vimalakirti, I bet people here would like to see your Buddha land, Abhirati, where you came from. And please show them that Buddha land. And of course, by this time, you expect anything in that sutra. So then Vimalakirti says, yeah, sure, fine. And he reaches out across the galaxies and he picks up the universe, Abhirati. And he brings it in his hand, it miniaturized, sort of like a little globe like this, which is a whole Buddhaverse, you know, like a planet, a solar system, whatever it is, you know, it's hard to say. And he shows it to people, and they see it. And what's interesting about it is it's very similar to the Earth, planet Earth, whatever their view of it was in those days. And yet the heavens and the human plane are interconnected by sort of, you know, Dallas Mall-type escalators, but rather giant ones. And the gods come down all the time to the human plane, and the humans go up to the different heavenly realms at will. And there are animals there, and mountains and forests. It isn't like a bunch of jewel lotuses like the Western paradise of Amitabha. It's more like a humanoid planet. But the Akshobhya Buddha is always there. He never goes into parinirvana. He never leaves his emanation body, his supreme emanation body. So that's why the gods come down, because they want to study with Akshobhya, the Buddha Akshobhya. So there are those two sort of Pure Land miracle visions, where Shakyamuni shows this vision, and then they show the vision of the Buddha Land Abhirati. And so, in a way, that's the category of what are called the Pure Land Sutras, or the Buddhaverse Sutras, you know, showing that there are sutras that have the most extraordinary visualizational texts where you visualize the, you know, these extraordinary realms, you know. And in the later, you didn't read, but some of you have read, but there's that chapter where Vimalakirti sends out for takeout from the incense universe.
Oh, yeah.
Right, he sends an emanation bodhisattva, golden bodhisattva, for takeout. And then that bodhisattva gets a little few grains of rice from the Buddha of that Sugandhakuta, it's called, universe, Sarvagandha Sugandha. Sarvagandha Sugandha is the universe, Sugandhakuta is the Buddha, and brings it back, you know. And then the bodhisattvas in that Buddhaverse, which is all made of incense, or perfume, it's just a perfume. Yeah, the trees are perfumed, the land is perfumed, the bodies are perfumed. And the Buddha never teaches with words in that Buddha land. He just emanates perfume, and then they sniff it, and they go into samadhis, and they learn a lot of things. And then they say in that light there are Buddha verses which are just everything is made of light. There are Buddha verses where everything is made of textures, etc. They go on like that. So then those... What?
What's one of the names of those sutras? Like, one of these...
The Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, the Pure Land Sutra, it's called, famous one, it's Pure Land Sutra, of the Western Paradise, Sukhavati Vyuha in Sanskrit. There is an old-fashioned translation by E.B. Cowell. I don't know if he did all of them, he edited it, E.B. C-O-W-E-L-L, published in Dover paperbacks nowadays, called Buddhist Mahayana Texts. And there's the Amitāya Dhyana Sutra and the Sukhavati Vyuha Sutra, and those are in there, and you can read them. And so there you have the Pure Land Sutras then. Then there's the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which is another 18 sutras, a collection of 18. I don't know how many in the Pure Land category, maybe 10 or 15. And the Prajnaparamita one is all kind of everything is empty, empty, no, no eye, no ear, no nose, no everything, you know. It's like pure... critical, negational wisdom, analytic wisdom that sort of takes everything apart and everything disappears under analysis, including the state of disappears. So that's chapter 5 and chapter 9, the non-duality chapter, and 5 is the consolation of the invalid chapter. And then there's this, maybe the most remarkable kind of sutra. Well, they're all very remarkable, but the one called the... Inconceivable Liberation, which relates to chapter 6 and some of the other chapters, some parts of the other chapters. And the Inconceivable Liberation is the Garland Sutra, or what is translated from Chinese nowadays and available in English, called the Flower Ornament Sutra. I mean, Tom Cleary gave it that name. And although flower ornament means a garland, you know, of a tamsaka. And that's the sutra where, you know, there's a Buddha land in every atom. So every atom, the whole universe is in every atom. It's like a holographic vision of reality where the whole universe is in every atom, and yet each atom is in its unique place in the universe, and that's the mustard seed thing.
Right.
And that has to do with relative reality, the inconceivability and miraculousness of relative reality. So those 5 or whatever number of sutra categories are all, it's like it was an anthology almost, beautifully. You know, Vimalakirti touches on all of them, and then even... where the goddess speaks up, that's almost like Tantra. She refers to Tantra and esoteric Buddhism, you know, with the mandala kind of idea. And Vimalakirti's house is like a mandala. It's like right. Doctor Who's TARDIS,
right.
Actually. But that's like a mandala, you know. You know the TARDIS?
Of course.
Is anybody here doesn't know Doctor Who? Oh, you're so... Oh, yeah, that's homework. You should watch the English sci-fi thing called Doctor Who.
So one of the questions that's sort of germane to this is that,
yes.
Is you know, we're curious to know, is this one of the later Mahayana sutras?
One of the what?
Is the Vimalakirti one of the later Mahayana sutras?
No, I don't think so. It was first translated into Chinese in 150 of the Common Era, right at the beginning of all the translations into Chinese, in the late Han Dynasty. That version was much more partial and fragmented than either the Kumara version in 400 or the Xuanzang version in the 7th century. But it was already translated then. And, you know, in the view of Mahayana Buddhists, the Vimalakirti dates from Buddha's time.
Right.
And was kept secretly, you know, or out of circulation for 400 years and then emerged when the Mahayana did. So I don't consider it. And nobody, actually, the Western scholars don't consider it a late one.
Okay.
The late ones, they think, are more sort of, when their way of understanding things, the late ones are where there's no Chinese translation, but the Chinese didn't translate all the sutras. So, you know, their system theories don't really work that well.
Mm-hmm.
But also where it's more devotional and more elaborate, you know, the descriptions right. of things, they consider those late. You know, they have a kind of, you know, Renaissance and then... And then post-Renaissance, then Baroque, then Rococo. Oh. You know, they have a kind of a theory like that, projected from the European art experience about Buddhist literature. But there's actually no knowledge at all. India, you see, the climate of India is such, and the paper used in India was palm leaf mostly. And so, and also the Indian intelligentsia in Buddha's time, before Buddha's time and long after, had phenomenal memories. And they would memorize enormous long things. And they were very systematic. And they had metrical and other technical ways of preserving things mnemonically very accurately, which has been proven in both Veda's side and in Buddha's side and Jaina's side. So they just don't date things, you know, very, very much, you know. Or the record of that has been lost. But and also there was so much destruction in India. Like, for example, Indian painting... there's literally no, like a Tibetan tanka on a cloth, you know, like an icon on a cloth, and which is called patta in Indian, like written on a piece of canvas or silk. There's not one single incident of such painting for 1,000 years before the Muslim came, because they burned it all, you know, they destroyed it all. Yes, you have samples of painting from 5th, 6th, 4th century in Ajanta and Ellora on cave temples, walls that were not found, you know, they were so remote or something, that are marvelous paintings, show a very, very, you know, high, excellent drafting and excellent figural, beautiful stuff. But you have nothing, absolutely nothing. So by the same token, the literature dating effort, only by Chinese translation is the only sort of peg they do. And, you know, they say, well, we'll allow 100 years before somebody translated, rule of thumb.
Right.
I mean, but there's no such rule of thumb, you know. And then a lot of it wasn't translated into Chinese. A lot more was translated into Tibetan many centuries later. So anyway, that's a little bit the scholarly thing. But back to non-duality. So what's the problem? Now, the Dharma door of non-duality, chapter 5, you know, is about the twofold selflessness. Does everyone know about the twofold selflessness? I call it now, when I translated it in these days, I didn't necessarily call it that, but nowadays I call it subjective selflessness and objective selflessness. That is to say, the selflessness of the subjectivity of the person and the selflessness of objects. And that's taught in this page 45, where he says, you know, he analyzes about sickness. You know, he's talking to Manju about sickness. You know, and sickness arises from the total involvement in the process of misunderstanding from beginningless time. It arises from the passions that result from unreal mental constructions. And hence, ultimately, nothing is perceived which can be said to be sick. In other words, the body, when you analyze it, you can't find the body. Like, there's a great thought experiment for you that I always teach to my students, which is find your nose. Anybody, try to find your nose. Everybody goes like this. But now, what you touch with your fingertip when you touch your nose could be sliced off in an operation, plastic surgeon, or an accident, and you'd still have a nose. So actually, that thing that you touch, this little bit of skin surface, is not actually the nose. Although, at the moment, it's part of it, you could say. But then part of what? Then try to find the boundary between the nose and the cheek, here, between the nose and the air inside the nasal passage. Is that air inside the nasal passage part of the nose or not? Then take a microscope and look at the skin, and then you see that, like, pores look like the Grand Canyon, you know, like a seemingly smooth skin looks really, you know, so where's the exact surface of that skin, you know, if you look at something with a microscope. Then do a thought experiment about the atoms that are in the nose, and then the subatomic particles of the atoms, the quarks, the bosons, the Higgs, Higgs is doing a big job on your nose, but then they said they didn't really see the Higgs boson. It's just it blew up and left traces that they mathematically, statistically think means there's a Higgs boson there. You know, the guys who went freaked out about having a Higgs boson? They didn't really, they don't really know what it is. And then all the dark energy, you know. So in other words, if you really analyze your own nose, what you realize is that anything you refer to as your nose or touch or see, you know, like this, is not your nose. So your nose is a, is made up of your unexamined nose, your habitual nose, what I call your lifelong hood ornament, is something that's there when you don't look for it precisely. When you look for it, like to really pin down the objective, essential, intrinsically objective nose, you don't find anything. It disappears under analysis. Do you follow? That's a great thought experiment because the nose, our noses are really part of our scene, you know, all the time, you know. And when you know when you meditate, you're supposed to let your eyes look at the tip of your nose if you have a long one, or not a little in front of the tip of your nose. You're supposed to slightly cross the eyes and hold them stable like that with them half closed. It's the ideal meditative posture for the eyes. So that sort of thing is a meditation on selflessness, you know, emptiness, right? And first, it's about the emptiness of the person. He says there's no one, so there's no owner. The body is the issue of the four main elements, earth, water, air, wind, and fire, which themselves are just abstractions, if he goes into analyzing them as he does in some other passages. And in these elements, there is no owner and no agent. There is no self in this body, meaning if you look for yourself, your Kim, your Laura, your Bob, your Chisti, if you look for that in there, you can't find anything. There's no little homunculus in there. You can't find a thing. And even the word, you know, Bob, the name, that's not really in anywhere, you know. It's just, and other people have the same name, so it's not your essence at all. Even though when someone goes, Bob, you jump, you know, a bit like it's hit something in there, it seems to. But, you know, somebody else, there's like two or three Bobs here. I think you're, who's a Bob? There's another Bob here. No, another Bob? No, another Bob. Mitchell, that's right, Mitchell, another Bob. So therefore, that's not the root of it. And so there's no self in this body. And except for arbitrary insistence on self, ultimately no pronoun I, which can be said to be sick, can be apprehended. Therefore, thinking I should not adhere to any self and I should rest in the knowledge of the root of illness, he or she, the bodhisattva, should abandon the conception of herself as a personality and produce the conception of herself as a thing, like an object, in other words, an inanimate thing, thinking, this body is an aggregate of many things. When it is born, only things are born. When it ceases, only things cease. These things have no awareness or feeling of each other. When they are born, they do not think I am born. When they cease, they do not think I cease. So that's subjective selflessness, in a way, in a short summary. Emptiness of the personal self, or subjective self. Then he goes on to analyze the conception of himself as a thing, and then the thing disappears under analysis, like the finger, the leg, you know, the organs, the skin, the bones, and that all dissolves under analysis, and that's the first. The body is like the closest object to us. But the table dissolves under analysis, the floor, the planet, the stars, the building, everything dissolves under analysis. And that's objective selflessness, right? And then a state of selflessness, like emptiness, when you first do that, you will have, and if you, when you do it meditatively, first you have to learn it as a critical, philosophical, analytic pattern. The ultimate, most useful version are the 27 critiques of Nagarjuna's book called Wisdom. The central verses of the middle way, there are 27 critiques which people would memorize, and then they would analyze time, space, cause, effect, substance, you know, all kind of 27 different concepts, you know, self, selflessness, actually nirvana, form, feeling, all these things would be analyzed and all disappear under analysis. And then when you do that meditatively, you have an experience where your mind seems to bore through itself and the world, and you come into what is called space-like equipoised samadhi. Samadhi really just basically means balanced one-pointed concentration. And you sort of disappear into it, almost. It's like, it's not like you're floating in a space like a little body sitting cross-legged floating in space. That also disappears. And you have this experience, which is felt, experienced as a great release and relief. Because there's a lot of tension in looking at, and then continuously failing to find what you're looking for, type of thing, you know. And then finally, even the looking process sort of becomes reflexive and dissolves itself. And then you have the space-like feeling. And many people mistake that space-like equipoise samadhi as an enlightenment. And in a way, it's a stage. It's very important to balance that with our usual habitual sense of the absolute substantiality and sort of solidity of everything, you know, that everything is a thing in itself, you know, which philosophers, mostly other than the Buddhists, for centuries, millennia, there was kind of like Socrates, they all came up with it, Plato, they came up with that kind of idea that there's some sort of essence and thing. So when everything disappears, including you, it's a big relief. It's a little scary. People will back away thinking, oh, I will never come back, or I'll die, or it's sometimes experienced almost like it would be like a death thing. Some people will, who are used to feeling that they're controlling everything by being in their body and differentiating themselves from everything else. But that the boundary dissolves, everything dissolves. But the key there is one has to be prepared by a knowledge that it's grained deeply in there, and this is where non-duality comes in, where when you're looking for some sort of an intrinsic reality of self or object, subject or object, and you don't find it, in a way you can kind of say the intrinsic reality of everything is its absence. But then when you look to find the intrinsic reality of the absence, the space, the emptiness, the feeling emptiness, what you thought was like no or nothingness, sort of very close to being not like nothingness. But when you do that, then you find what's called the emptiness of emptiness, which means that this state of, and it's almost like you have to have a momentum of critical concentration and reasoning, the reason of relativity like that. You have to have that momentum, because when you reach that state, you're no longer thinking discursively. You're in a kind of trance. But your mind automatically starts to scan your mind, which is not like, again, something in your head anymore, because you're not feeling you have a head, but your consciousness projects itself even in this empty state after the first release feeling, and it realizes, of course, that this state itself disappears. It starts looking for the state. It's like when you're in space, then there's north, south, east, west, like, where's the space? Space disappears. And when the space apart from things disappear, what happens is the things return. All the things are back. You're there. You had a spaced out a moment, or it could have been long. There's one famous Han Chan, the famous Chinese Chan poet. He was stirring his porridge one morning, and he wasn't thinking about all this, but he had been meditating about it all along. The Prajnaparamita, transcendent wisdom. Critical wisdom, not just not thinking, like a simplistic way of teaching Zen. He had been drilling down to find reality, what substance that would resist his analysis. And he was stirring, and he didn't detect any interruption in the stirring. There was no sense of time in his release experience. But he simply noticed that the porridge was cold, the fire was out, and there were 3 days' worth of dust on the porridge. So he had a gap. Kind of, he'd been spaced out for 3 days, and then he sort of ground to a halt on his stirring, and then he sort of had to inferentially figure out what had happened. And then he said everything seemed to him like it was all upside down, and the whole of the universe was reflected in a giant mirror. He had a kind of impressionistic vision like that after that. But anyway, that was where the thing that happened to him. So he was so deep, maybe, that, you know, he didn't even have a sense of threshold about it. It just instantaneously 3 days passed as he was stirring. And he stopped. Cold and dusty porridge. And I think that is that space-like. And then what's called the illusion-like aftermath samadhi is followed on by the space-like aftermath samadhi. And so it's very key. There are some people running around nowadays who are Buddhist teachers who run around saying, I realized emptiness, so I'm enlightened, so forget about it, you know, like whatever. And they're stuck there. And they wrongly think emptiness is some place elsewhere. Nirvana, it's like they're like the Theravada, they think Nirvana is some other place, right? Whereas the emptiness of emptiness means that emptiness is all these things here. Actually, it's the relativity of all these things is what emptiness is. Because every one of them is empty of any non-relative component. That's really the simple essence of non-duality, actually. Right? But on the other hand, it's called illusion-like aftermath samadhi or dream-like aftermath samadhi. Why? Because there's the habit pattern of still seeing things as if they were solid, born of their own intrinsic essence, separate from oneself. Oneself feels separate from oneself. So there are the degrees of it are, there's a kind of oscillation when one first has the experience. And then Buddhahood is therefore defined as the time when Buddha perceives things in both ways instantaneously, completely. Perceives them as if they were, as other beings see them in an illusory way, and doesn't see them at all. And that's why compassion, you know, there are four types of compassion, of universal compassion, having to do with which level of intelligence or wisdom they are paired with. And the first one is what's called sentimental or false compassion, which is someone thinking, oh, I'm so sorry for all suffering beings, it's so terrible, it's awful, it's horrible. But it's paired with ignorance, where one thinks that the way they are is just the way they are and there's nothing can be done about it. You can't do anything about it. You sort of just feel pity, but it's powerless because you just think everything is what it is. And that's called sentimental and actually even anunaya drishti, compassion born of a concept of affection or a concept, a sentimental conception, something like that. It has no strength. Then the first level of universal compassion that is somehow valid is paired with the wisdom of impermanence, where it realizes that everything is changing all the time. And therefore, it has yes, all beings are suffering and I feel compassion for them, but they can get rid of that suffering. And my compassion is my will that they do get rid of it. And then whatever acts I might do, but the compassion is just a mental push to eliminate that finds their suffering unbearable and wants to eliminate it, right? So then, the next one is where, and that's called the compassion that perceives persons, paired with the wisdom of impermanence. Then the next level of compassion is based on the wisdom of personal selflessness or subjective selflessness, where in a way one sees through the persons, based on seeing through oneself as a personality, then one sees other beings as processes or events or things. And so that's called the universal compassion that sees events or things, not persons, but feels sorry because some of those events are feeling suffering. So it wants to help change that. So it has that second wisdom of objective selflessness. Then the highest universal compassion is the universal compassion that does not perceive, which has no perceptual object. That is to say, it does not objectify the target of the compassion. It simply feels the feeling of the compassion, and therefore it's automatically unbearable to that level of bodhisattva or Buddha. And that's a Buddha's compassion. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it is the oneness of the compassionate being with the target of compassion. They don't see anything different from themselves in that sense.
Right.
They don't see anything. Right. Okay.
Where does fierce compassion come in?
Well, at any level, it can come in. If it comes in paired with ignorance, that's just more or less fierce because that's just wrong. It's not real compassion.
Yeah.
So then someone might take an excuse of, I'm so sorry for them all, so now I'm going to go kill them or something, you know, or kill someone who's harming them. You know what I mean? It's not a real thing. Fierce compassion is just compassion that is moved to help beings free themselves from suffering And sometimes it requires some sort of ferocity, the type of suffering that it is. Like, in a way, you could say surgery is fierce compassion. Okay? Surgery is the 18th different strategy out of 18 that a doctor uses in Buddhist medicine. It's not the first. It's the 18th out of 18. But in some cases, it's very necessary. And yet, that's cutting into somebody, right? Or, you know, you might, if your bone has healed wrong, you might re-break the bone, you know, and that's fierce, you know. That's tough love. So surgery is fierce compassion, for example. It's just, fierce compassion is just, because universal compassion paired with one of those wisdoms is incredibly skillfully effective. Because just like you are very, when you're a mother and the child is deeply suffering, you will do everything in your power. And mothers do have great skill, and they almost can read the mind of the child. They know when it needs more food or less food, or when it needs to be burped, or whatever is the story, you know. Mothers are pretty good at it, actually. And, you know, maybe not have some skills that some specialists have when they have certain ailments of a child, but they're pretty good sensing what's wrong with it. And when someone truly loves some being that's suffering, then one will make every effort to do what is right to help them release and alleviate their suffering. And although finally, of course, from the Buddhist point of view, that's why the Bodhisattva wants to be a Buddha, because you have to really completely know the karma and know the structure and know everything about every another being to really be able to help them. You know, so you should be clairvoyant to be a teacher, really, that's what they call a spiritual teacher, because you're taking responsibility for someone else's. Like, remember in those stories, Vimalakirti sometimes scolds this Upali for ordaining everybody as a monk. He says, some of these people don't need to be a monk. They've already been monks in previous lives. They're bodhisattvas, and they're doing a better job as lay people. So don't ordain everybody and think they're all the same.
Right.
Remember he does that?
Yeah.
And various times he doesn't approve of what some sort of teachers who are valid, but they're not spiritual teachers in the sense that they are not telepathic. If you're, and whatever, you have to be a true spiritual teacher, not an academic teacher or something like me, but a true spiritual teacher, you basically have to have those psychic powers of clairvoyance, etc., telepathy, clairvoyance, to be able to be really, really responsible teacher.
Right.
To really know if what you're doing is really helpful. Because the Buddha's teaching, Buddha, oh, that's why Buddhism can be confusing, because Buddha taught different things to different people, because that's what they needed. You know, he taught according to their need. He didn't just spout one dogma that everybody had to conform to. Because basically he was trying to help them come to an understanding. So to do that, you have to know where the misunderstanding lies in that person. Right?
Bob, I think one of the questions that came up today was the difference between intuition and telepathy. And also...
And what, telepathy?
Yeah. And then also the second part of that question is why are you recommending the why have you gone from the gnosis translation to,
well, gnosis is kind of good in that it sort of, people think of it immediately as a kind of mystic sort of experiential knowledge, but the Gnostics in the West were highly dualistic. They hated the body. They were like, they're a little bit hysterical. You know, they wanted to go off and be angels. And so it's this kind of like mysterious business. Whereas the word jnana, meaning arya jnana, noble knowing, which the Tibetans translate as ye she, and ye meaning ye ne sheva, meaning knowing it primally or primordially, having known it, in other words, knowing something that you've always known, is not mysterious, actually. For example, in talking about non-duality, I was going to go to the ninth chapter. In the ninth chapter, Dharmador of Non-Duality, Vimalakirti and Manjushri, then the Lichabha Vimalakirti asked the Bodhisattvas, there are 32 Bodhisattvas, he says, good sirs, please explain how the Bodhisattvas enter the Dharmador of Non-Duality. And then each one comes up with something. Noble sir, production and destruction are two, but what is not produced and does not occur cannot be destroyed. Thus the attainment of the tolerance of the birthlessness of things is entrance into non-duality. And then the one that I love in this, according to the Tibetan tradition, the Bodhisattva Priyadarshana, on page 74 is the previous life of Nagarjuna in the Buddha's time. He was the Bodhisattva in the house of Vimalakirti called Priyadarsana.
All right.
But look what he says. He says, matter itself is void. Voidness does not result from the destruction of matter, but the nature of matter is itself voidness. Therefore, to speak of voidness on the one hand, and of matter or of sensation or of intellect or of motivation or of consciousness on the other, is entirely dualistic. Consciousness itself is voidness. Voidness does not result from the destruction of consciousness, but the nature of consciousness is itself voidness. Such understanding of the five compulsive aggregates and the knowledge of them as such by means of intuition is the entrance into non-duality. Now, intuition can also be mistaken. So it depends on how we define the word. For example, a racist has an intuition in the sense of a direct feeling that the target of her or his racism is something inferior, something subhuman. And they don't have to think about it. It's a directly feel that. So that's kind of a distorted intuition. Underlying it is a bunch of false concepts. But they're so ingrained in a person that they feel that's just the way things are. Right? On the other hand, in Western philosophy, Kant defined intuition, and pretty much that definition holds, as an unmediated direct experience without any conceptual control to it. And therefore, both Kant, although he differed from Dharmakirti, the great Buddhist logicians, in that he didn't have a theory of wisdom, unfortunately for him, and for later Western philosophy, so he just thought that, you know, that kind of intuition could never reach its target. So the thing in itself was something unreachable by people, you know. But in a way, it was encountered, but it couldn't be somehow understood, or something like that, he thought. Whereas Dharmakirti says that intuition, Buddhist logicians, Dignaga, Dharmakirti being the two foremost ones, when you intuit something, it's when you directly encounter it and you merge with it in a way, and it defies your concept. For example, this is the difference between seeing blue and seeing, quote, blue, unquote. Do you follow me? In other words, the idea is there's a split second when you like look up at the sky or something, or you go into a place where there's just a big bunch of a colorful wall, where it's just, you are the blue, and you don't identify it right away as, quote, blue, unquote, if you follow me. Then, of course, but we normally, our conceptual data bank in our brain is so fast that immediately blue jumps out when we see blue, if we speak English. You know, azul, you know, if we speak Spanish, ngombo, if we speak Tibetan, whatever, you know. And we routinize that so much that in ancient time, I think, or even, you know, people will kill each other over calling Allah or God or Yahweh or something, you know. They'll consider it a big disgrace if someone doesn't use the word that they use because they think the word is somehow in the thing, if you follow me. It's like the concept lives in the thing, which it doesn't. The mind instantly projects it there. Now, why I'm going into this, it might sound a little bit pedantic to you all, but why I'm going into this, each of these bodhisattvas said something like what Priyadarsana just said. But then, at the end, then Manjushri says, and this is very, very famous in Vimalakirti, then the crown prince, then Manjushri replied, you know, after their explanations, then they asked Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? And Manjushri replied, good sirs, you all have spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality. Then the crown prince Manjushri said to Lijava Vimalakirti, we have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality. Thereupon the Lijava Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. And that's called, and then notice, right after that, Crown Prince applauded him and said, excellent, this is indeed the entrance of non-duality. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas. And when these teachings were declared, 5,000 bodhisattvas entered the Dharma door of non-duality and attained the tolerance of the birthlessness of things. And note that knowledge here is called tolerance, although that's a stage. There's tolerance and then there's intuition, ultimately. But tolerance means somehow bearing something inconceivable, you know, tolerating it. Like cognitive, tolerating the cognitive dissonance of things being, seeming to stand out as if they were things in themselves and yet being nothing but merged into emptiness relativity, you know, and completely mysterious and therefore illusory. Now, of course, though, there is one caution that the sutra contains. Earlier on, Shariputra says to the goddess, when she has just scolded him and he therefore changes the subject, on page 59, he says to her, goddess, how long have you been in this house? He's changing the subject because she just teased him because he was freaking out about something, which we can talk about, but I'm just trying to make a point. And she replied, I have been here as long as the elder has been in liberation. You know, as long as you've been in Nirvana, I've been here, she said. Because she was visible, and she only just appeared in the house. You know, she was not manifesting physical embodiment until a little bit before this. So then Shariputra's a little bit not sure about what to say about that. So then he says, then have you been in this house for quite some time? And she says, has the elder been in liberation for quite some time? You've been in Nirvana for quite a while, haven't you? At that, the elder Shariputra fell silent. So here's another silence. Did many people get enlightened? Does she praise him for that? No. She says, elder, you are so-called foremost of the wise. Why do you not speak? Now when it is your turn, you do not answer the question. So Shariputra tries to defend himself. He says, since liberation is inexpressible, goddess, I do not know what to say. And then she says, all the syllables pronounced by the elder have the nature of nirvana. Why? Nirvana is neither internal nor external, nor can it be apprehended apart from them. Likewise, syllables are neither internal nor external, nor can they be apprehended anywhere else. Like elf, that's a syllable I just made. And that's not only internal, it's not only external, it's not really in between, like you can't find that syllable, actually, you know, under analytic, ultimacy-seeking analytic wisdom. Therefore, Reverend Shariputra, do not point to liberation by abandoning speech. Why? The holy liberation is the equality of all things. Now, I assign this as an essay question to my students every year. What is the difference between the two silences? So in your case, I'll give you a quiz. What is the difference? Why is Vimalakirti's silence liberating and wonderful, supposedly? And why is Shariputra's silence not wonderful? Why? Any takers? Huh?
Well, for starters, Shariputra is obviously stumped.
Okay, well, Vimalakirti might be stumped. The Manjushri just said before that you shouldn't say anything. You might just be obeying Manjushri, fitting in with this straight man who sets it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if stumped. I mean, of course, Shariputra is stumped, but why is he stumped? This is the key. Think further. He's stumped.
Was there,
yeah.
Was there a lot of pride involved in his?
Well, I don't know about that, but. Not at this point, I don't think it's a pride issue. He has that problem, but it's not the pride issue. He says, he gives the real reason. He says it's inexpressible. And he definitely had an experience of liberation of a sort, to a certain degree. He did. You know, Shariputra did attain that. And at that time, he was something unbelievable, inconceivable, and inexpressible, he felt. But he's thinking it's something that he's pointing to with it by not speaking, that other people, that is inaccessible to other people. Mm-hmm. So in a way, his silence withholds from them, like connection to that liberation. It's a withholding silence. He's thinking, he's holding some memory of an experience in his mind, thinking that's what's referred to by a referential silence, actually. He's referring to it by, you people can't understand, I can't express it to you, and so I'm not going to say anything, right? Vimalakirti, on the other hand, you know, I always compare this to, you all know something about Hinduism, a little bit, you know, there's the famous thing in Hinduism called the Mahavakya, the great expression, and that is how you attain enlightenment in Vedanta, is you have to be a Brahmin, you have to have a Brahmin teacher, and that Brahmin teacher then tells you, Tattvam Asi, that thou art. In other words, you are God, you are Brahma, you are Brahma Nirvana, you are Brahma, Brahmahood, you're God, right? And there's other versions of it, Aham Brahmo Asmi, I am Brahma, you know, this kind of thing. So just hearing that with a certain kind of faith and openness, then you feel one with Brahma. That's the Vedanta. But non-duality means Nirvana is here. This is Nirvana, right here, right now. Even with us in it, not knowing it experientially. Even if we have the theory of non-duality, that Nirvana has to be here if it's really Nirvana, but we somehow can't touch it, right? We think, but of course our thinking is ignorant thinking. So maybe we are touching it without recognizing that we're touching it, if you follow me. So what Vimalakirti did there in that specific context, 32 people have drilled down, taking all kinds of pairs of concepts, dualistic concepts, one by one. And then Manjushri cuts, you know, goes even deeper by saying, well, all of them are just dualistic concepts. His language is dualistic. And then what do you say, Vimalakirti? And then he's supposed to be the authority, because by this time he's been performing miracles and doing all this stuff, so he's like Buddha to them all. And then he doesn't say anything, but not to point to anything elsewhere. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say anything because he sees them all and himself as Nirvana. And this gives them, subliminally, a sense of being in that Nirvana. A sense of, all right already, if you will. You follow me? So that's why it's liberating. It's not a withholding. It goes along with the vision of everyone else, it's fine. Because obviously Buddha has to see that, you see. Buddha would abandon his bodhisattva vow, Shakyamuni Buddha, you know, our latest one, or any Buddha, which is that they will not attain freedom from suffering until all beings have been free from suffering. So he would break that if he felt some sort of blissful release while seeing others still trapped in some terrible agony of suffering. Do you follow me? That would be breaking the bodhisattva vow. So what that means is he has to see everything as nirvana, as just bubbles of bliss, ocean of bliss, bubbles of bliss, even beings in hell, which is pretty hard to imagine for us, but that was just necessary. And then it connects probably, you know, I think, to the fact that he sees through the solidity or the concreteness of time. And so he realizes, he sees everyone as fundamentally all right and yet still holding on to their ignorance and their suffering. But he enfolds them in a compassionate matrix wherein he can see technically their evolutionary development as optimally leading them toward that enlightenment, toward the omega point, like Taya Dushardin called it, you know, or Buddhahood, you know, their own Buddhahood, which is where Kalachakra comes in, you know, the Wheel of Time. The Wheel of Time is where he is a Wheel of Time. You know. It's a vision of time, Nirvana as time, but here, on the one hand, ultimately the unreality of time, emptiness of time, as seen as a sort of solid medium, but two, the extension of time to beings who need the evolutionary time. It's like a flower. If you went and you could see in the seed of the rose bush, you could see the beautiful rose. And then you somehow went into it and pulled out its gene or something. It would just destroy the seed. you can't do it. You know, it has to grow with the right conditions in the greenhouse with water and fertilizer and soil and whatever. You know, you can't just rip the seed and pull the flower out of it. If you follow me, even if you can see the flower that's going to come. You know? So beings are like that. You know, they have their own organic process, evolutionary process, but they could be worse or better. They could go on being idiots and suffering and going in and out of hell and animal forms and lounging around in boring Trump Tower heavens and ridiculously wasting their time for on and on, life after life. And so the Buddha, the Kala Chakra, is an image of the Buddha's universal compassion as skill in liberative art, or liberative technique, as I was saying in those days, where he shapes the world even to teach them with maximal effectiveness. He didn't create it, and he can't just... If he was omnipotent, then there would be no need for them to learn. You know, they'd instantly be enlightened when he was. But that we're not. But we will be. In his instant, we will be. In our instant, it will take time. Something like that.